Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
If all my bets were safe, there just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you, this is Behind the Bets.
Welcome back to another episode of Behind the Bets with Doug Kazarian, presented by DraftKings. A lot to sort through, but we are not going to be doing NBA. I know everyone's jonesing for it. I just didn't have time in the schedule being the week, and there's a lot of moving parts. So I'm saving sort of like the NBA preview, if you will, for when the playoffs get going. So there'll be a little bit of a lag. We'll do the NBA, and we'll get ready to fire. But I did write a column that posted on ESPN Chalk saying this year, more than any other year in the 73-year history of the NBA, I think underdogs have a chance of ultimately winning it all. Now, underdogs have in the past, but you're looking at 31 of the last 36 NBA champs have come as a one or a two seed. I mean, this sport, as we know, is just chalk, 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 the best of seven format, obviously, versus single elimination, March Madness, and other sports. So I just think the way it is, the volume of possessions, we all know this, more predictable than others. However, no neutral court, and no home court. It's a neutral court. And then just the corona variable, the unknown. So a lot of reasons to think, expect the unexpected, so to speak. But with all that being said, like I wrote in my piece, it could just mean it's a little bit more difficult for the favorites rather than actual upsets occurring. But it's fascinating that the Bucks are favored more now than they were in March when people were assuming it would be through their home court. So they're minus 230 in the East. They were 220 in the East in March. And now they have to do it on a home court and everyone well rested. So it'll be fascinating to see how it all plays out. Much more NBA coming up. But on this pod, we're talking golf. And we're talking UFC like we have a lot of these midweek pods throughout the summer. So Wes Reynolds going to break down the WGC event coming up. And then we have another UFC card, this one stateside with Matthew Holt coming up in a little bit. But I want to remind you, basketball is finally making its return to television. Make sure you're keeping up with all the news inside and outside the NBA bubble with Adrian Wojnarowski on the Woj Pod. Download and subscribe to the Woj Pod as well as Behind the Bets with Doug Kazarian on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop. Hammer time.
All right. I'm shocked when he doesn't pick the winner of a tournament. Shame on you, Wes Reynolds.
Yeah, from the penthouse to the outhouse. That's how it can go in betting, and especially in golf, getting a winner the week before and then having all the guys miss the cut the week following. So that happens from time to time. So get back on the horse and ride again this week.
I like it. Well said. Now, we got the PGA looming a week in advance. How much does that factor into your handicapping, if at all?
Not a ton, because predominantly most of the high-end players are here this week in Memphis, with the exception of Tiger Woods skipping the event. Adam Scott hasn't played since the restart. Justin Rose, Lee Westwood, just a few players not going to play this week, but you pretty much got a lot of the field that you've had in most of these events. So, look, it's a WGC event. So, usually, more often than not, it's going to be a class player. That doesn't mean some longer odd guys with some pedigree can't win. But more often than not, you're going to see a good player win this type of tournament.
Okay. So, how are you approaching this tournament? Because obviously, it's a different format.
Yeah. Just looking at previous years. I know this is interesting because there's only been, now this will be the second WGC event, FedEx St. Jude, but they did have the FedEx St. Jude Classic in Memphis. I'm not being overly reliant on the course form simply because it's a different type of event. That FedEx St. Jude Classic, because I know there's been some cases made, obviously, for Daniel Berger and for Dustin Johnson, both multiple-time winners here at this event. But that FedEx St. Jude Classic used to be like the first week of June, first or second week, a week or two out from the U.S. Open in early June. Now it's in late July, first week of August, going into the weekend. And I don't know if you've been down in Memphis, Tennessee in late July or in August in the summertime, but it gets pretty hot and sticky down there. And so the conditions are going to be a little bit different. So it's hard to evaluate and handicap players' fitness and whatnot. But some guys the heat's easier on them, and some guys the heat's harder on them. But I didn't get too knee deep in the weeds in terms of doing that. So, but I didn't overly rely on the course form that normally you would when the event is played kind of in the same time of year.
Okay, good handicap there. Anything else stand out with these non-cut events?
Could you repeat that? I'm sorry.
I said interesting handicap. Anything else stand out with these non-cut events?
Yeah. Well, one of the guys that I played this week, actually, he plays very well in these non-cut events. And the fact that four of his five PGA Tour and European Tour wins, because there was one win he had that counted for both at a WGC event in China. And the guy that really stood out to me was Xander Schauffele at 22-1. And he was my first play on the card, the first one I bet. And he started out strong at Colonial in the restart back in June. Third place finish. He actually probably should have won the event. He missed that short putt on 17 on Sunday, which ended up costing him the victory. So then, you know, maybe that takes a couple times to get over and a few weeks to get over when you let one slip away like that. And then if you'll recall, a couple weeks ago at the Memorial, he was 8 over on Thursday through 13 holes. Started out horribly, had a triple on the card, had a couple balls in the water, but he never gave up on the round. He ended up finishing with a 6 over round, but was able to come out on Friday, make the cut on the number, finished plus one for the tournament, which doesn't look overly impressive. It was a tie for 13 finish, but the conditions we know were pretty darn rough for the Memorial. It was very windy. Pins were placed in very difficult locations, especially on Sunday. But Xander Schauffele did rebound from the tough start. He led the field at the Memorial in driving accuracy and in greens and regulation. And going back to that no-cut point you brought up, look at his wins. 2017 Tour Championship at East Lake, 2018 HSBC in China, 2019 the Tournament of Champions, the opening event of the calendar year out at Kapalua in Hawaii. And then he was also in the playoff last fall, once again at that China event, I believe with Rory McIlroy. And then earlier this year, he was in the playoff with Justin Thomas, who eventually won the event, and Patrick Reed. So he does very well for some reason in these like no-cut events, shorter fields, only 78 players in the field this week, by the way. Third on tour in greens and regulation, fourth in par four performance, which is going to matter a little bit this week simply because it's a par 70, so you got 10 par fours. Eight of those par fours are 450 yards or greater. So you got to keep it in the fairway, and you got to have good approach shots because these greens are smaller than they usually are. So I'm going with the guy with a good tee to green game, and that's one of those things that I kind of saw when I hit on Rahm a couple weeks ago. Find a small, subtle buy sign where Rahm didn't finish well at the workday, but he shot 64 on Sunday. So you thought, okay, he's figured something out. And that's kind of what I'm banking on with Schauffele here. On him at 22-1 this week, and I've already bet him several weeks ago, 25-1 for the PGA.
You know, I'm actually on Schauffele too, and it's because of these WGC stroke play events. So over the last five calendar years, every one of these events has been won by like kind of an elite golfer, right? So 40-1 or lower, and in terms of odds, and then they all have had a ranking in the top 20 except for Mickelson, and obviously Mickelson. So eventually, like the elite, not eventually, but the elite ultimately wins these events. So, and they're usually a major winner. Schauffele's the only one since 2016 not to be a past major winner to win it. So you kind of need a guy, and I like payouts obviously, so I kind of need that like next tier guy, so I grab Schauffele as well.
Yeah, absolutely. He totally I think fits the profile, and I've already bet him for the PGA. He was one of those guys I targeted before the beginning of the season to say, okay, this is a guy. John Rahm, of course, part of that list as well. These are guys that are going to break through and get their majors sooner rather than later.
Okay. And then any others that caught your eye?
Yeah, he's a guy in the mid-30 range, and he's been a pretty elite player. I mean, he doesn't have a major yet, but he's been a pretty elite player this year that nobody really seems to talk about a lot. And that's Tyrrell Hatton from England, who is ranked 14th in the world. I've had some personal luck with Hatton because hit on him last November at the Turkish Airlines Open, got home with him at the Arnold Palmer Invitational earlier this year in Orlando. But he is starting to, I think, really show some good pedigree. He hasn't had a lot of rust in the restart when the schedule had to be readjusted due to the pandemic, but he's been very selective in the tournaments he's played. Was third at the RBC Heritage down at Hilton Head, and was also fourth in Detroit at the Rocket Mortgage Classic. Those are the only two events he's played so far in the last month and a half or so, but he's got the look of a player that I think is really primed and focused for the bigger events like WGCs and like the majors. And you look, he's top 10 in greens in regulation, second in strokes gained approach. He's fifth in strokes gained tee to green. He's also a very good par four performance, I mentioned. I think he's fifth overall on tour. And he's third in scrambling and first in strokes gained putting. And you got to be able to scramble here this week because the greens are so small that you're probably going to miss some. That means you're probably going to hit good shots and they're going to bounce and they're going to get in the fringe or maybe in the first cut of rough just outside the green. So you're going to have to be able to chip and pitch and run a little bit and also putt as well as you possibly can. Brooks Koepka, who won this event last year, who I almost played and may still add if the price can go back up a little bit, shot 16 under and winning this event last year. He was first in the field in scrambling. So scrambling really matters here. This is not a pitch and putt type TPC course, not like the TPC course we saw last week at the Twin Cities. This is a little bit more difficult. Fairways a little more narrow. Greens a lot smaller, about 4,300 square feet on average. So Tyrrell Hatton was one that I think really stood out to me. I can't go against the form. He's got as good a form as anybody. Rahm and DeChambeau obviously get the hype, and Thomas and a lot of the other guys there in that top five, top 10 in the world. But Tyrrell Hatton's been up there consistently with all of them for how he's played so far this year.
Okay, interesting. That's not a name I was expecting, but let's run with it. I'm okay with that. Are you sitting down, Wes?
I am sitting down.
Okay, because I'm going to my other bet is Tony Finau.
Okay.
Look, I know he's a punchline at a lot of these things. I get it. And frankly, I'm the one delivering a lot of those punchlines. But, I mean, when you have these odds this ridiculous, I think you have to play it because his form has been so good. So it's I got 55-1. It's down to 45-1. I'm just checking Caesars in front of me. Obviously, there's a lot of options out there. His play is strong. I get it, but he just can't close, can't win. But his talent's there. He's changing caddies this week again, so maybe that's the answer. Who knows? But I just had to take it.
Well, I can't necessarily say that that's a bad idea here. I actually did add a small bet on him for next week's PGA in the mid-40s. And like you said, he's changing caddies. He split with Greg Bodine after the Memorial. He had Boyd Summerhays, the swing coach, on the bag last week, but Boyd is caddying for his nephew Preston, I believe, in a Korn Ferry Tour event. So another different caddy this week for Finau. But what I think is going to end up happening, Doug, is I don't know if it's going to be a major. Hopefully for my wager's sake, it will be. But it's going to be one of these really big events because we've seen how close Finau has been. He's got, I believe, the stat that I saw, or the angle I saw, was 30 top 10s in the last 4 years that Tony Finau has, and how the number of top 10s without a win on the PGA Tour. And his last win was the Puerto Rico Open back in 2016. Ever since, he's got 30 top 10s. That is the most of any player on tour by far. Second most is Tommy Fleetwood, who, of course, is playing over here more in the States now, who has plenty of wins worldwide but doesn't have the win on American soil yet. And Fleetwood's got 16 top 10s. So that's a huge gap there between 30 and 16. And I think what is going to happen with me now is he's going to win a big event. Like all this heartache and all of these coming close and whatnot, because he was the only short price guy that was even in contention at the 3M last week. And I get that people are going to look and say, oh gosh, he couldn't get it done at the 3M against a bunch of triple digit 100-to-1 plus shot guys. You know, how is he going to get it done in a big event like a WGC or a major? But that's golf. Like, that's what happens, right? I mean, it's going to come when you wouldn't expect it. You'd expect him to lay waste to some easy field, but not against one of the better fields in the world. So I'm not mad at that Finau pick at all.
I agree. It's going to happen at some point, right? Like to your point, now, I don't know if it's a major, but I think at some point it's going to happen, and I'm just going to try to find the needle in the haystack with the good payouts. So those are the only two I have. Do you have any others?
Yeah, I got a couple more. I ended up on five this week. A couple of them were were just price plays. And I got Sungjae Im near 80-1. I just thought that the price drifted up enough where I had to take a little shot. The stoppage in play came at the worst time possible because this guy was playing like a top 10 player in the world. There weren't 10 players in the world better than this guy back in March when he won the Honda Classic, came back next week off the deck with a third place finish at the Arnold Palmer. And then he started 10th, a respectable 10th on the restart at Colonial. But his solid tee to green game really kind of left him, because then you looked, missed the cut at the Heritage, down in the 50s finishes for the Travelers and the Rocket Mortgage, 63rd at the Workday, misses the cut on the number at the Memorial. So the form doesn't really grab you and say, okay, this guy is ready to win. But he took a needed week off, and then I just think the price drifted up enough in a short field where he could be a little bit of a mild surprise on that first page of the leaderboard come Sunday. Going to buy on the dip here, and I'm going to do the same thing also with Paul Casey, who I found at 100-1. This was a guy that I actually played early, and not going to end up with the best of the number on Paul Casey because I thought he was going to start to play well this summer, but I mistimed it, and he drifts up to 100-1 this week, and he's still worth a look. Look, I know he's missed back-to-back cuts, but this is a guy, when you look at the stats all of the characteristics that you're looking for when you're evaluating for winners on a given week, top 10 in strokes gained off the tee, ninth on tour, sixth in strokes gained approach, 12th in greens in regulation, number one in total driving. And the total driving stat obviously takes driving distance plus driving accuracy in terms of those two individual rankings to come up with a number. So he's first in total driving. And with driving this week, you've got to be the right combination of long and straight, especially this week with some narrower fairways. But we know what the drill is with Paul Casey. We know his ball striking is terrific, is as good as anybody's, but it's the putter. I mean, Paul Casey all of a sudden becomes Par Casey, and he's very frustrating to watch because he'll knock a shot to 5 or 6 feet, and you're like, okay, we got an easy birdie here. We're going to pick up a shot here. And then all of a sudden, if you're looking at PGAtour.com, like if it's not on the air early in the morning, okay, 5 feet to the hole, and then you click on it, and then he's got a putt coming back for par from about 4 feet because he's knocked it 3 or 4 feet by. So that's what happens with Paul Casey. He's got a little better record on Bermuda, but it took him at 100-1. And then one guy who's actually never won on the PGA Tour because he is a rookie, but have a feeling he's going to like this place. I took Scotty Scheffler at 80-1. Tough start on the restart. This was a guy, him and Hovland were kind of the two guys that were going to likely battle for Rookie of the Year. That still may be the case. Tied for 22nd at the Memorial is his best showing since they've resumed play. And look, getting a PGA Tour maiden win against a field like this is not going to be an easy task, but four of the last 10 winners, at least at Memphis, have won on their course debut. Westwood, Dustin Johnson, Harris Inglis, Daniel Berger back in 2016. Scheffler, top 10 in strokes gained off the tee, top 10 in total driving, top 10 in par four performance. So statistically he fits, even though that name doesn't really jump out at you when you've got so many top 50 world ranked players in the field. This is a guy that's not going to jump out at you, but yet he's only 80-1. You would think this guy would be like 150-1 in a real long bomb in this field, but he's not. So that shows me he's getting at least a little bit of respect in the market.
Interesting. So that's quite five plays. Now I would imagine you vary your unit size.
Yes.
And is it?
Yeah, I usually play shorter or more on some of the shorter prices. Like I'll have more on Joplin and Hatton than I will on Scheffler and Gacy.
Gotcha. And then you had, and I think the voice cut, I just want to make sure. So you have Sungjae Im is that guy before Casey, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Awesome, my man. Well, good stuff as always. We got the majors starting or resuming next week with the PGA Championship. So looking forward to next week as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck, Doug, this week. And thanks for having me on. And good luck to all the listeners.
All right, let's welcome in our good friend, Matthew Holt of U.S. Integrity, as the UFC comes back from Fight Island, back in Las Vegas, back to the smaller octagon. Matthew, how are you?
I'm doing great, Doug. And yourself?
Well, doing all right. We did well last week with the over-unders. Could have been better on the sides, but, you know, that happens. That happens, but we
Doug,
turned the
on
page.
The wrong side of a coin flip decision.
Yeah, there was a lot of controversy, and that's the case with these judges sometimes. And, you know, you and I have texted during the fight, like, what's the rationale from these fight organizations, whether it be boxing, UFC, whatever, in terms of not posting the round scores round by round instead of holding it to the end?
I know, and nobody's ever done that in history, boxing or MMA, but we recently saw a couple of smaller organizations, including LFA, which is one of the bigger regional promotions, announced that they were going to start doing it, and I love it, and I think it's going to happen soon. And it's such an advantage for the fighters. Whether or not you or your cornermen think you won the first two rounds, wouldn't it be nice to know you're down 0-2 and have to get that finish? I think it'll make for a lot more exciting finishes to fights when one fighter knows he has to go out there and get it done.
Well, that's the whole thing. You got to know where you stand instead of just one guy playing possum when he's actually losing by two rounds or whatever. Right. You know, it just makes sense. What other sports do you have where you're not keeping scores until the end? So we'll end the soapbox. We'll get into this card, UFC Fight Night. Not the biggest names on the card. We'll go through some of these quickly. And there's been some steam here on the favorite, Shahbazyan, with this middleweight division fight. He's been dynamic. He's never lost UFC or MMA. Makes a lot of quick work with his opponents. And, you know, sadly, I see this kind of happening again with an over-under of 1.5. I think it's going to be a quick win for him.
Question here, though, and I do agree with you, is what happens if it's not a quick win?
Right.
So Derek Brunson's one of those guys where he's kind of been all over the place. He's 4-4 in his last 8 fights, but his losses are to Yoel Romero, Ray Souza, Robert Whittaker, and current champion Adesanya. So, I mean, his losses are to all legit cream of the crop guys, the number one contender Whittaker, the champion, and some of his wins aren't that bad either. But what I noticed is when he went through that stretch where he was losing a little more than he was winning, especially against elite guys, that he kind of fell in love with that left hand, you know, which has scored him 11 knockouts and 20 wins. But now he's on a 2-fight win streak, and what he's got back to is that wrestling that has really kind of led him early on, which was his bread and butter, and it's led to 2 straight wins all of a sudden. What I wonder here is, if he's able to get that wrestling going early, as awesome as Shahbazyan has looked, 22 years old, 5-0 in the UFC, 4 stoppages, 4 of the 5 wins in the UFC coming in the first round. But the one time that he got taken out of the first round against Darren Stewart, and let's face it, if nothing else, Derek Brunson's better than Darren Stewart, he ended up being in a split decision. He didn't look good in the later round, Shahbazyan, which isn't surprising for a 22-year-old that really goes for it in the first round. So my fear here, and we've talked about it so many times, you know, correlating parlays or finding value in certain places. If you think Brunson has a shot in this fight, you definitely have to play over, because that means in the smaller cage that Brunson was able to get his wrestling going, where if you like Shahbazi, and history says his best performances come when he's able to get people out of there in the first round, I'm actually going to favor the over here. I'm a little nervous in a five-round main event. Oh, are they going to keep this one three, actually, I think, right?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
They're keeping it three rounds because the, you know, it wasn't supposed to be a main event, and Holly Holm just very recently pulled out. I think this is going to be the very, very ultra-rare UFC main event that's only a three-rounder. But regardless of that, we only have to make it 7.5 minutes here. We know main events historically tend to go over since COVID. We're getting plus money on the over. And I worry about what Shahbazian is going to look like after round one. So I think this is a little correlated. If you like Shahbazian, maybe you could play the under instead of laying 320. Where if you have any question marks about whether this one's going to go over, you might also lean toward Derek Brunson at the big plus price.
Okay. So correlated, if you can find a shot that does the parlays, you get a little bit extra payout on the underdog there. All right, the co-main event is on the women's side in the flyweight division. You have Joanne Calderwood and Jennifer Maya Calderwood, the favorite here, and it's trickled up a little bit as well. Do you agree with that move on the steam?
Yeah, I think that Calderwood has certainly moved up. You know, she was supposed to get the next title shot, really, which is amazing. You know, that shows you how thin that division is, really. But I think that next title shot now is probably going to go elsewhere. But this is an interesting fight because these two sort of replicate each other. They both lost to Chookajian recently. And, you know, obviously Chookajian fought for the title, and her only loss, like in her last five fights, was against Valentina Shevchenko for the title. But Calderwood's just 3-3 in her last six fights, with the losses every time she steps up. Chookajian, Jessica Andrade, Cynthia Cavallo, where Maya is kind of the same, 2-2 in her last four in her UFC career, lost to Chookajian, beat Roxanne Modafari and Alexis Davis, people that she probably should have beat. Same thing for Calderwood. Her wins come over Andrea Lee, Ariana Lipinski, who hasn't been very good, and Kalindra Feria. So at the end of the day, both these women have struggled when they stepped up and beaten the lesser fighters in the division. I actually think this fight's really even. The one interesting part of it, and it, of course it's baked into the line, we have an over-under here of 2.5 minus 400. Eight straight fights for Jennifer Maya have gone to decision. So she really is a decision machine. So when you see that over minus 400, that's why. At the end of the day, this one's probably going to go the distance. You know, Maya's fights all do. They're pretty even. If Maya can get it to the ground, she's probably going to win a decision. If it stays standing the whole time, JoJo Calderwood will probably outbox Jennifer Maya. But this fight's pretty close. I don't have a bet either. But if you forced me to bet, as this line keeps steaming up, I would probably take Maya in the big plus.
Yeah, I mean, these women's fights tend to go the distance. And we saw that with the last fight. I forget who it was, but it was like a minus 470. We were toying with the under, and of course, it did go over on that one. All right, next down on the card, we're going to go to official plays by you. So we're going to talk about the co-main event, but you do have a play here in the next match between Randy Brown and Vicente Luque. This one in the welterweight division. And why don't you just take it away with your first official play on the card?
I was blown away to hear some really sharp MMA people I know, or at least see that some of them are betting on Randy Brown. But the two sharpest MMA people that I kind of reach out to after I make plays, both like Vicente Luque as I do here. The only bewildering thing to me is Vicente Luque is 12-2 in his last 14 fights, 7-1 in his last eight, and the only two losses are Wonderboy Thompson, a top five welterweight, and Leon Edwards, who may get the next title shot. It's him or Gilbert Burns who's going to get the next title shot at Kamaru Usman. So two of the top five fighters in the world. This is a guy who's been ranked for a while now, has a very fan-friendly style, and is only 28 years old. You would think the UFC would be pushing this guy to fight other ranked guys because they want him in the title picture because he's so exciting. And, oh, by the way, he's so good. This is a guy who's beaten Nico Price twice, Brian Barberena, Platinum Mike Perry, Bilal Muhammad, who just had an amazing performance. I mean, Vicente Luque's resume is legit. And on the other side, I just don't understand why he's fighting a second-strength, unranked opponent. I understood the Nico Price fight. Their first fight was so good. You're trying to kick off this amazing pay-per-view card with COVID going on. Why not put on a barn burner for the fans and fight Nico Price again in Florida, where Nico's from? And oh, by the way, it was a barn burner again. What an amazing fight that was. But now why are you fighting Randy Brown? Why aren't you fighting one of the top welterweights in the world? It just doesn't make any sense. And if we look at Randy Brown, I mean, these guys have a lot of opponents in common. Randy Brown lost to Nico Price, who Vicente Luque beat twice. He lost to Bilal Muhammad, who Vicente Luque beat. This is a guy who hasn't been able to get it done. His wins come over Mickey Gall, who's massively overweighted, an older Worley Alves, Brian Carmozzi. He's just 2-2 in his last four fights, yet he's getting the opportunity of a lifetime fighting against a ranked welterweight here. Look, Vicente Luque doesn't lose to these kind of guys, and in most cases, he buries them. This is another one that I actually have two plays on. I laid the wood with Vicente Luque because I really thought he should be minus 350 here, and I also thought laid a little bit on the under because you get plus 155, and throughout his career, Vicente Luque is a finishing machine. 16 of his 18 wins come by finish, and he's a guy that has a lot of ways to finish you quickly. So I took the under plus 155, and I also laid the wood with Vicente Luque, which to me on paper looks like a little bit of a mismatch.
Okay, I like it. Emphatic plays coming out of the gate strong, your first official plays on both the side and the total. We'll keep it moving down the main card. This is a rematch of a fight from a few years ago, Vanata and Bobby Green, and the rare draw, which you don't see very often in the fight game, boxing or MMA. And you have a play here as well.
Yeah, I took Lando Vanata, and mostly just because he's been so active. And I really like guys that fight a lot. I think it helps you stay in that routine. It keeps you in the gym. Lando Vanata has fought 9 times since 2016, 5 times since these two fought last and had that draw in October of 2017. So I like the fact that he's keeping busy. They both fought Dracar close. They both lost the decision to close. And at the end of the day, but the problem with Green here is he's just, for whatever reason, the judges never seem to appreciate his style. And he goes the distance in most of his fights. 9 of his last 10 fights have gone the distance, yet he's just 2-5-1 in his last 8 fights, with the two wins coming over a 40-year-old Clay Guida at the end of his career and an Eric Koch, who isn't even in the UFC anymore. Every other time he stepped up, it's in Barbosa, Close, Poirier, Rashid Magomedov, Francisco Trinaldo, who he just fought. They all beat Bobby Green. On the other side, Lando Vanata himself is only 2-2-1 since the fight with Green, but he's been fighting a lot. I think he's the more active striker, where I think he's going to throw more volume here. Bobby Green tends to not throw a lot of volume, and that's not good for a guy who's most of his fights go the distance and doesn't have knockout power. I like the activity from Vanata, who's a little bit younger, and I think at the end of the day, he's just going to out-volume Bobby Green and end up winning a decision in this fight.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you there. I like it when these fights are priced around this range, but you typically like to look to dog money, but it's hard to get on the dog in this case. I'm with you on that one. Let's finish out the card here. Again, I'm on a favorite. Obviously, this is a different price. Kevin Holland against Trevin Giles, and we're finishing out the main card, I should say. This one in the middleweight division, I just don't see a path to victory, really, for Giles.
Yeah, and the big trouble here, and this is a battle for Texas. Both of these guys are from Texas. They were supposed to fight each other on the regional scene, and they never got to. Now they get to battle in the UFC. They're both fairly young. I think one's 27, one's 28, so they're both right in their prime. The big problem Giles is going to have in this fight is that Holland is 3 inches taller and has a big reach advantage. And that could be a little
bit too much. 7 inches.
Yeah. I mean, that's the problem that I think Giles is going to run into here. And so he has to get this fight to the ground. But Kevin Holland has shown lately that he has some tremendous athleticism. I think as long as he keeps it standing, this is probably Holland's fight to lose. But it was a little too pricey for me, so I passed.
All right, can't blame you there. Maybe I'll look at some props to reduce the juice or maybe even throw in some parlays or just lay the 210. So I haven't fully decided on that one. Let's go to the undercard. And you're on the dog here with Frankie Saenz and Jonathan Martinez.
Yeah, look, there were so many of these cards on the bottom. I looked to the total on this card, and I thought there were some opportunities there because to potentially play the over, but it was juiced a little too high for me. Martinez has never been knocked out. Both his losses are due to decision. One of them is actually due to an illegal knee. He's 2-2 in the UFC and had a bad decision loss to Andre Ewell in his last fight. He probably should have won Martinez, but he is so crazy in the octagon. He's wild. His striking is wild. He's kind of all over the place. He constantly puts himself in bad positions, where Frankie Saenz is actually the complete opposite. He's always composed. He's well past his prime now at 39 years old. But he's still booking big fights. This is a guy who just fought Marlon Vera in his last fight, and his losses are to Uriah Faber, Marlon Vera, Eddie Wineland, the former title challenger at 135 pounds. And he has what I really like about what could be a grappling battle here is Frankie Saenz has a recent win over Merab Dvalishvili, who we just saw dominate as like a minus 900 favorite on one of these early Las Vegas cards before they went to Fight Island. The fact that you could out-grapple that guy is unbelievable. He also out-grappled Enrique Quinones. So a huge strength of schedule and experience advantage here for Frankie Saenz. And even at 39 years old, it is possible that Martinez lands something big in the first round. Again, we're in the apex, so we only have a 25-foot octagon instead of the 30-foot octagon. So I understand the steam on Martinez, who's a big puncher, and Saenz, who's getting older and got KO'd in his last fight. But that KO came against Marlon Vera. Jonathan Martinez isn't Marlon Vera. I think Saenz will be able to take advantage of some of those wild exchanges, get the fight to the ground where his wrestling is elite, and maybe steal a decision here at a pretty generous plus price. I got plus 175.
All right, so you're grabbing it there. You know, there's bigger prices out there, actually. So that's interesting. So you grabbed it early. But right now, I mean, I'm just seeing at Chris, I'm actually seeing plus 200-ish, no?
Yeah, they're steaming Martinez for sure.
Right.
And look, I get that Saenz is 39, but other than the age issue in this fight, I think it's a lot closer matchup.
Okay, good stuff. A couple other plays for you. Let's go to the light heavyweight battle of a couple guys, same size, Ed Herman, Gerald Meerschaert, both 6'1", same reach as well, same weight obviously as well too. What you have a read here on the total?
Yeah, I played under 1.5 rounds, plus 165 here. And again, both of these guys are finishers. 23 submission victories in 31 wins for Gerald Meerschaert. 29 of his 31 wins come by stoppage. He's lost 13 times. 10 of those 13 losses are by stoppage. 14 of his last 16 fights didn't go the distance. Same thing almost with Ed Herman on the other side, a guy who's 25-14. 20 of his 25 wins come by stoppage, and 9 of his 14 losses he's been finished in. These are two guys who either get the finish or get finished in almost every single one of their fights, and because of that 25-foot octagon in the apex, they're going to collide really early on, and I think someone's either going to get hurt on the feet really quickly or end up in a submission very quickly in this fight. Neither one of these guys are exactly fleet of foot, are going to try to do a lot of movement. My guess is this fight ends up on the ground within the first minute of the first round, and somebody locks in a submission here before these two can get real sweaty, and we're getting plus 165. Hey, the stats say that these two don't go the distance. I don't understand why the price is so high toward the over, so I took under at plus 165.
Well, it's over on 1.5, not 2.5, so that's why you're getting the plus money. But, yeah, no, man, it's I love betting all these different ways, and if you like the plus money, go for it. And when you're doing under 1.5, you got basically a blackjack hand, right? Like, got a quick finish, so to speak. So, final play for you on the card, middleweight division, Spicely and Perez. And you're on another total here.
Yeah, I took over 1.5 rounds in this one. It really interesting for Marcus Perez. This guy is an all or nothing submission guy. He's 3-3 in his last 6 fights. All 3 wins by submission early. All 3 losses went the distance, and he lost a decision. He just doesn't have enough offensive output to win decisions. So I looked at Spicely, but I probably needed a little bit more juice to play the underdog here than I was getting. So I decided that at the end of the day, Spicely trains at a great gym in Syndicate MMA, hasn't been submitted at all in his last 5 fights. Last time he was submitted was way back against Antonio Carlos Jr., one of the greatest submission jiu-jitsu artists that there is in middleweight MMA, and that was even at the 359 mark around 2. I just think Spicely is strong enough on the ground that he's going to be able to avoid the early submission, and that over 1.5 rounds minus 140 is probably the best play, especially for a guy like Spicely who's not likely to get a finish himself early in the fight. Eric Spicely never scored a knockout in the UFC, not likely to come here. This one probably gets well into round 2 or 3.
Okay, good stuff on that one. A lot of action here in the UFC. It's been a busy stretch here. The Fight Island ended successfully. If you ask me, and I think if you ask anyone, and great job by Dana White just stepping up to the plate when we didn't really know about sports forever. And, back in the States and back in the smaller octagon.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, this is card lucky number 13 since COVID started for UFC. So let's give them some credit. This will be the 13th card they've put on since May in the middle of a pandemic. Thank you, Dana White and the UFC, for all the entertainment you've provided us over the last 3 months.
And thank you, my friend, for all the entertainment you're providing our podcast listeners. Have a good good weekend. Good luck on the card, man.
You as well. Thanks, Doug. Take care.
Kicking is for losers.
All right, that's going to do it for this edition of the Behind the Bets podcast. Thanks to everyone for downloading, rating, reviewing, subscribing, all that fun stuff. Thanks to Matthew Holt. Thanks to Wes Reynolds, and a lot of exciting stuff, right? Basketball's back. Obviously, baseball's having a little bit of a hiccup, but hopefully that'll sort itself out. It's going to be a lot of twists and turns for all these sports, and we've managed through the summer. Now American team sports are back, so it's exciting, and hopefully we can all stay safe out there, and the players can as well as we move forward with the sports calendar.